Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 517, Update on September 11th and Related Matters. This is being recorded on July 3rd of the year 2005. We're going to begin Side with discussion of the continuation of a case in Switzerland against a prominent Saudi businessman who has been accused of financing Al-Qaeda and other terror groups. This fellow's name is Yassin Al-Qadi, and he is perhaps most significant for our purposes because he was among the major financiers of a company called P-TECH. Not only Yassin Al-Qadi, but many of the other people connected with P-TECH are basically part of the Al-Taqwa Muslim Brotherhood / Al-Qaeda milieu, something well worth noting because it was P-TECH, basically something of a capital offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, that was devising the threat assessment software architecture for the FAA and the Air Force and NORAD on September 11th. They also developed software architecture for the Department of Energy as well. That department oversees nuclear power plants. And considering that P-TECH, in terms of an institutional capital assessment, is basically simply an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood, as is, by the way, Al-Qaeda, that is a pretty scary development indeed. We're going to highlight the continuation of the Swiss case against Yassin Al-Qadi right now. I would note that Operation Green Quest in the United States, the pursuit of terror financing in the U.S., has been badly attenuated not only through the activities of Messrs. Mueller, current CIA or FBI director, but also Michael Chertoff, who was in charge of Operation Green Quest and proved less than vigorous in that position. And Michael Chertoff is now head of the Department of Homeland Security. Chertoff himself with links to people apparently involved in the funding of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Of the continuation of the case against Yassin Al-Qadi in Switzerland, what remains to be seen whether his activities in the U.S., including P-TECH, are followed up on to any extent. But of the Swiss continuation of the case against Al-Qadi, we read the following. This is from MSNBC/Newsweek, and specifically this is from the Michael Isikoff and Mark Hosenball column. It's called Anti-Terror Victory? Swiss prosecutors have decided to pursue a criminal case against a Saudi businessman accused by the United States of financially supporting Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. I would note that the Swiss case against Bank Al-Taqwa at the core of the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002. The Swiss case against Al-Taqwa, has been suspended due to the fact that, among other things, the U.S. refused to provide documents to the Swiss about that investigation. In addition, Bank Al-Taqwa's Bahamas branch and, surprise, surprise, the Saudis have also withheld key information that the Swiss wanted for their pursuit of Bank Al-Taqwa. But again, Bank Al-Taqwa is very well connected, and among the people representing Youssef Nada, the head of Bank Al-Taqwa, is none other than Pier Felice Barchi, a law partner or a former law partner of the current Swiss Justice Minister Carla Del Ponte. Of the Swiss pursuit of Yassin Al-Qadi, we read, the U.S. government's campaign against alleged terror financiers has won a potentially important victory with a decision by Swiss prosecutors to pursue a formal criminal case against a prominent Saudi businessman long accused of providing support to Al-Qaeda and other terror groups. The businessman, Yassin Al-Qadi, was first named by the U.S. Treasury Department as a, quote, specially designated global terrorist, unquote, in October of 2001 as part of a major campaign by the Bush administration to demonstrate it was cracking down on terror financiers in the aftermath of September 11th. The U.S. action prompted a number of governments, including the Swiss, to freeze millions of dollars of Qadi's assets. But his case also has raised serious questions about the strength of the U.S. government's evidence, little of which has ever been made public, regarding the murky world of terror finance networks. Qadi, a top target of U.S. investigators, has repeatedly denied all accusations of terror ties. And more than 3.5 years after he was first designated by Treasury, No criminal charges have been brought against him, either in the United States or anywhere else throughout the world where he does business. That may now change. Earlier this month, in a move long sought by Washington, Swiss Deputy Federal Prosecutor Claude Nicotti asked a Swiss federal criminal tribunal to assign a juge d'instruction, or investigative magistrate, to prepare a possible criminal case against Cotti. Swiss criminal investigations proceed in three stages. In the first stage, prosecutors and police work together to gather the evidence for a criminal prosecution. In the second stage, an investigating magistrate sifts through evidence gathered by prosecutors, interrogates witnesses, and decides, much as an American grand jury is supposed to decide, whether there is enough evidence to send the case for trial. In the third stage, the investigating magistrate would send the case to criminal court judges, in Cotti's case, federal judges based in the southern Swiss city of Bellinzona, who would try it and determine whether the defendants were guilty of any crime. The Cotti case is the first terrorism finance case that Swiss prosecutors have moved to the second investigative stage since 9/11. According to Cotti's lawyer, Nicotti's four-page letter to the federal tribunal focuses in particular on a series of transactions between February and August of 1998 in which one of Cotti's companies, Caravan Development, transferred $1.25 million to a firm owned by another Saudi businessman, Wael Juleidan. Juleidan, a reputed one-time associate of Osama bin Laden during the guerrilla war against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, was placed on both the United Nations and the U.S. terror finance lists in September of 2002. The money transfers were supposed to be used to build dormitory housing for an Islamic school in Yemen, the sort of religious and charitable activities that both Cotti and Juleidan have long contended they have openly supported. But the Swiss letter alleges the funds, quote, ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda, unquote, according to an excerpt of the letter read to Newsweek by one of Cotti's lawyers. Skipping down. Mark Widmer, a spokesman for the Swiss prosecutor's office, said that the investigation referred to the federal tribunal was one of three major terrorism investigations that Swiss federal prosecutors had recently been preparing for possible transmission to the Federal Criminal Court, a new Swiss tribunal set up after 9/11 to handle complicated cases, including terrorism investigations. One case, which Widmer said that federal magistrates were already examining, involved the arrests of nine Muslim immigrants to Switzerland following sophisticated attacks on residential compounds in Riyadh in May of 2003. According to a copy of the criminal referral in that case obtained by Newsweek, Swiss police opened the case after receiving information indicating that 36 Swiss cell phone numbers were recorded on the memory of a cell phone used by one of the members of the terrorist cell that carried out the Riyadh attacks. Earlier this month, however, Swiss authorities disappointed Washington when Nicotti's office confirmed that it had decided that it had insufficient evidence to refer to the criminal tribunal a long-running investigation of another allegedly major terrorism finance network called Al-Taqwa, based in the Bahamas in the southern Swiss city of Lugano. Al-Taqwa, numerous related companies, and several of the network's principals, including Al-Taqwa's elderly Egyptian founder, Youssef Nada, were all officially, quote, designated, unquote, terrorist financiers by the United States and the UN in 2001 and 2002. Well, again, recall that among the reasons why the Al-Taqwa investigation was shelved was the fact that the U.S. did not give critical documents to the Swiss. Also, the Saudi Arabians and the Al-Taqwa branch in the Bahamas were also less than forthcoming. But the Operation Green Quest raids are basically... the principal element of those goes to the Al-Taqwa milieu, and vis-à-vis Yassin Al-Qaeda, his P-TECH Corporation, or the corporation he helped to fund, P-TECH, was basically also, the investigation of that also subsumed under the Operation Green Quest umbrella. And again, it was PTEC, essentially little more from a capital standpoint than an offshoot of the Al-Taqwa milieu and the Muslim Brotherhood. PTEC developed the threat assessment software architecture for the FAA, the Air Force, and NORAD, in addition to the Department of Energy. And again, that I think that a proper investigation of Operation Green Quest, Bank Al-Taqwa, and PTEC would yield an awful lot of information about the September 11th attacks and the world of PTEC and Al-Taqwa and the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002 also have many, many tributaries leading in the direction of the Bush administration as well. There has been a key development vis-a-vis U.S. and Saudi relations. Whether this has something to do with any of the ongoing investigations into September 11th and related activities, I don't know, but that certainly is one of the possibilities that needs to be carefully considered. Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, has announced his resignation after some 22 years. Prince Bandar bin Sultan has been the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. since 1983. He is so close to the Bush family that he's often referred to as Bandar Bush. We're going to touch on some of his links to the elder and the younger George Bush in a minute. One wonders why Prince Bandar has suddenly resigned after 22 years. One of the possibilities that needs to be carefully considered concerns the fact that Prince Bandar has shepherded a number of accounts on behalf of Saudi Arabia in the Riggs Bank of Washington, D.C. That bank has long held accounts for various clients of, among other institutions, the Central Intelligence Agency. The Riggs Bank has been deeply involved with some of the financial elements of U.S. covert operations over the many years. And as we shall see, Prince Bandar was no stranger to some of these operations. And one wonders to what extent some of the accounts that he held in connection with the Riggs Bank and some of the investigations into the Riggs Bank in connection with, among other things, September 11th has something to do with the timing of Prince Bandar's resignation. Also, I wonder if perhaps some of the unfolding investigations into Yassin al-Qadi and others in the Operation Green Quest milieu is also making things hot for Prince Bandar. I would note, although we're not going to talk about it in this program, that it appears that the source for the leak that basically compromised Valerie Plame, former ambassador to Niger Joseph Wilson's wife, the source for that leak now appears to have been Karl Rove, as many have theorized from the beginning. If, in fact, Rove does turn out to be the focal point of the leak, that, too, could shake an awful lot of fruit out of the tree, out of the political tree in Washington, D.C., because if Rove goes down, an awful lot of people are going to go down with him. Karl Rove, one of the people who, along with Grover Norquist, helped to form the GOP-Islamist link, and that GOP-Islamist link is one of the things that would be uncovered if Operation Green Quest were properly pursued, and it's one of the things that would be uncovered if the PTEC investigation, part of Operation Green Quest, were also properly pursued. So what exactly has caused the timing of Prince Bandar's resignation? Was it the continuing case against Yassin al-Qadi? Is it some of the findings of the Riggs Bank investigation? By the way, a director of that bank is Jonathan Bush, the current president's uncle. It remains to be seen. But certainly what we can say is that the resignation of Prince Bandar at this time is in all probability very significant because his position as an intimate of both George Bush, and as a major player in the U.S. and Saudi world of covert operations places him in a very, very, very sensitive position vis-a-vis a number of ongoing investigations. Following articles from the Financial Times of London of June 28th of 2005, this article is by Stephen Fiedler in London and Guy Dinmore in Washington. It's headlined, Saudi ambassador to U.S. resigns. Prince Bandar bin Sultan, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. for more than two decades, has resigned his position. According to people close to the Saudi government, Prince Bandar, the longest-serving ambassador to Washington, has decided to quit. However, he will remain formally in his role as ambassador until an announcement from the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The announcement could take months. The Saudi embassy in Washington said that a statement on Sunday in which it said that Prince Bandar remained ambassador to the U.S. still stood. Quote, Prince Bandar is currently on vacation and is expected to return to his office at the end of August, the statement said. But one Saudi government advisor said, quote, he is determined to go. But as there is no formal decree relieving him of his duties, he by default and by name remains ambassador, unquote. Another said that Prince Bandar, 56, had already moved his belongings out of the Washington residence, though this could not be confirmed. Several reasons are cited for his expected departure, including poor health, which has encouraged him to spend more and more time away from Washington in recent years. But he is also said to have lost influence in Riyadh as the ailing King Fahd weakens and his expected successor, Crown Prince Abdullah, gathers more of the reins of power. Quote, it's a question of how seriously he is taken in Riyadh and how much confidence they have in him, said an advisor. Prince Sultan, Prince Bandar's father, is expected to assume the title of Crown Prince when Abdullah becomes king. Prince Bandar's high profile had also become a source of increasing controversy within the U.S., and there were questions about whether this was helping Saudi efforts to improve relations with Washington. These sources said that Prince Bandar was not expected to return to Riyadh in a senior policy role. There was no word on who would be his likely successor. According to the Saudi government, Prince Bandar did not attend a meeting in Riyadh last week between Crown Prince Abdullah and Condoleezza Rice, the White House National Security Advisor who was on a tour of the Middle East. The Saudi embassy in Washington was represented by Prince Salman bin Sultan, Prince Bandar's half-brother and a possible successor. Prince Bandar, a former Saudi Air Force pilot who trained in England, was appointed ambassador to the U.S., in 1983. Well, indeed he was, and again, Prince Bandar was so close to the Bush clan that he was often nicknamed Bandar Bush. And as such, as the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar was also a collaborator with the Bush administration in a number of different covert operations in the 1980s and 90s, including the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs. We're going to talk about those in just a second. We should note here in this regard that, first of all, Prince Bandar was, again, appointed ambassador to the United States in 1983, and as such became a major collaborator with, among others, the elder George Bush in many of the covert operations of the 1980s. We're going to turn now to the book House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties. This book was published by Craig Unger, and copyright 2004. The ISBN number, etc., will be in the description for the book, in the printed description on the Spitfire website. Of Prince Bandar's collaboration with the Reagan administration and the elder George Bush in launching the Iran-Contra affair, launching the support for the Contra guerrillas in Nicaragua, part of the Iran-Contra affair, we read as follows in House of Bush, House of Saud. The Saudis had no particular interest in Nicaragua. They didn't even have diplomatic relations with this small country half a world away. But at the time, congressional opposition to the administration's policy was so strong that on December 8, 1982, the House of Representatives voted unanimously to prohibit the use of U.S. funds to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. However, even the Boland Amendment, as the bill was known, was not an insurmountable obstacle to a National Security Council that was prone to macho covert operations, bravado, and cowboy-style adventurism. It considered a variety of options to fund the Contras, including obtaining funds from other countries and skimming profits from arms deals with Iran. Finally, in the spring of 1984, National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane raised the possibility of approaching Prince Bandar for the money. If the Saudis were to accede to the request, clearly they would gain favor from the Reagan administration. On June 22, 1984, Bandar and McFarlane agreed that the Saudis would give $1 million a month to the Contras. But the gambit was like playing political Russian roulette and had to be approved by the White House before it could proceed. What would happen if Congress found out? On June 25, 1984, a special meeting of the National Security Planning Group was called to discuss the issue. The highest officials in the country were present: Ronald Reagan, George Bush, George Shultz, Caspar Weinberger, William Casey, and Robert McFarlane, among others. According to minutes taken at the meeting, James Baker, ever the vigilant attorney, argued that actively soliciting money from third countries such as Saudi Arabia could be an impeachable offense. But Vice President Bush took issue with that position and said there was nothing wrong with encouraging third parties to help the anti-Sandinistas so long as there was no explicit quid pro quo. Quote, "The only problem that might come up is if the United States were to promise these third parties something in return, so that some people could interpret this as some kind of exchange," he said. Bush, after all, had been director of the CIA. The way to do it, he seemed to be saying, was for the United States to let the Saudis finance the Contras. Afterward, the United States could then reward the Saudis for their loyalty, but the two events would have to happen without being explicitly tied to each other. And so Bandar deposited $8 million in a Swiss bank. Over time, the amount given by the Saudis to the Contras reached $32 million. No explicit promises had been made to the Saudis, so the administration could assert there was no quid pro quo, and therefore no impeachable offense had taken place. And yet the Saudis did not go away empty-handed. After all, tens of millions of dollars had changed hands. At the time, King Fahd and Bandar wanted several hundred Stinger missiles from the United States, which had put restrictions on the sale of such weapons. To help the Saudis out, President Reagan invoked emergency measures to bypass Congress, and 400 Stingers were secretly flown to Saudi Arabia. By the way, in a footnote here, it should be pointed out that with regard to the $32 million ultimately given by the Saudis to the Contra effort, it says Salem bin Laden was said to be involved with this effort. Salem bin Laden was apparently one of the investors through James R. Bath and Arbusto Energy, the younger Bush's first energy venture. He also was the brother of Osama bin Laden and died in a mysterious explosion in 1988. It's been theorized that Islam and Osama bin Laden wanted their brother out of the way, but Salem bin Laden deeply involved with the covert operations of the 1980s. Continuing, the Saudis had received their payoff. To put it baldly, in exchange for doing something that had been explicitly prohibited by the House of Representatives by a vote of 411-0, Saudi Arabia received lethal, state-of-the-art weaponry it would not have been allowed under normal circumstances. The Saudis had come a long, long way from their first few airplane deals with James Bath, but in many ways their dealings with the House of Bush had just begun. The Reagan-Bush administration and the Saudis were not just helping the Contras. Early on, the administration also used Prince Bandar as an intermediary to meet Saddam Hussein, and soon Bandar told the United States that Iraq was ready to accept American aid. Even though Congress had never have approved arms transfers to Iraq, the Reagan administration secretly began allowing Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Egypt to transfer U.S. weapons, including howitzers, helicopters, and bombs, to Iraq. These shipments may have been in violation of the Arms Export Control Act. Prince Bandar was also deeply involved with the support effort for the Afghan Mujahideen. That effort also involved the elder George Bush, and of course it was the spawning ground for Al-Qaeda. Skipping down more about Prince Bandar's role in helping to fund the Mujahideen. By this time, Prince Bandar had become King Fahd's trusted point man in Washington. When William Casey approached Bandar about Saudi Arabia's funding an escalation of anti-Soviet forces, the two men flew to Jeddah with Bandar serving as Casey's translator for the meeting with Fahd. Casey met a receptive audience. This campaign was uniquely appealing to the Saudis. Not only would it enable them to cement their ties to the United States, it would also help the royal family with domestic unrest. And so the House of Saud eagerly joined in, matching, quote, America dollar for dollar in supporting the Mujahideen, as Prince Turki, longtime head of Saudi intelligence, puts it. And still later, of the relationship between Prince Bandar and the younger George Bush. And indeed, Prince Bandar was very much looking forward to a return of the Bush clan to Washington in 2000 in order to boost his own stock. As the, quote, election, unquote, results were being finalized in 2000, we read the following. Even before the Supreme Court decision awarded the presidency to the Republicans, the Bush team began behaving as if it had won. The election took place exactly 10 years after the buildup of American troops in Saudi Arabia for the Gulf War, and to mark both that occasion and the impending Bush restoration, former President Bush and James Baker had proposed a hunting trip in Spain and England. The original guest list included the usual suspects from the Gulf War: the senior Bush, James Baker, Dick Cheney, General Norman Schwarzkopf, the commander of U.S. forces during the war, former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, and, of course, Prince Bandar, whose enormous estate in Wychwood, England, had been an ancient royal hunting ground used by Norman and Plantagenet kings. And skipping down, Bandar eagerly anticipated seeing the Bush family back in Washington. Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld were men Bandar already knew quite well. Others who would have access to a new President Bush, his father, James Baker, and Brent Scowcroft were also old friends. Moreover, a Bush restoration would also strengthen Bandar's position in Saudi Arabia. During the 12 years of the Reagan-Bush era, Bandar had enjoyed unique powers, partly because of his close relationship to Bush, partly because he always had King Fahd's ear. So, again, what exactly is precipitating the sudden resignation of Prince Bandar? Is it the Riggs investigation? Who knows, but it is a very, very significant resignation, and we shall see what we shall see in terms of its implications. Again, a great wealth of material available on the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, thousands of pages of printed descriptions, links to a website maintained by listeners in the Midwest that feature the declassified U.S. government documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. The website has a search function. The first two lectures that I've done, downloadable on both MP3 and real audio, and also links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU. The heroic WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record shows on real audio. More recent programs are at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available at a longer URL that's linked both to that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. WFMU is also podcasting the For the Record shows. And note that on the Spitfire website, there's a page to click on for information about people who would like to assist the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like the things you're hearing about, there'd be no better way to fight back than to assist the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 517. Update on September 11th and related matters. This is being recorded on July 3rd of the year 2005. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.